Hello and welcome to a very special edition of the Silverline podcast series. My name is Gareth Westwood, Head of Global Intelligence, and it gives me great pleasure today to welcome our South Asia analyst, Supriya Ravishankar, our lead Asia Pacific analyst, Dr. Hugo Yu, and a special guest expert that we have, Michael Kugelman. Michael is director of the South Asia Institute at the Wilson Center. He's an acclaimed leading specialist on Afghanistan, India, and Pakistan. And we're very, very lucky to have him join our panel of experts here today. So welcome, Supriya. Welcome, Hugo. And welcome, especially, Michael. So without further ado, I'd like to start actually with something that happened as we're recording this on the 15th of March last night. And I'd like to first ask Supriya, what do you make of the clashes outside Khan's house that occurred yesterday and this morning, actually, in Zaman Park? And what is the likelihood of such episodes repeating?
Hi, Gary. Thank you for your question. I think what we saw yesterday was Khan really making the best of a bad situation. The fact that we had paramilitary forces at his doorstep ready to arrest him, and he was able to turn that into content and give interviews and some leading international channels like Al Jazeera, BBC, and Sky News, I think it really shows his ability to strategize under situations of stress. And the Zaman Park episode, I think going forward, will put him in a stronger position, particularly ahead of bi-polls we have coming up in Punjab on the 30th of April and then Khyber Pakhtunkhwa as well. But I think for me, the biggest takeaway from yesterday was the fact that he was able to galvanize such a large crowd, despite the fact that his Long March protests that we saw last year was fairly unsuccessful in its ability to achieve its objective. But the fact that he was able to get his supporters to basically conduct protests across the country, in fact, even outside of Pakistan, there were diaspora communities in Norway and London that also held small protests. The fact that he could still do that shows that he still very much is a major threat to the government. And regarding whether we could potentially see this episode repeating, I do think so, because there are around 80 cases against him. Some of them he has non-bailable arrest warrants out for, some of them not so much. But it is definitely a turbulent time. And I definitely think the government will try to arrest him considering his growing popularity.
Thank you, Supriya. And Michael, a very warm welcome again to Sibylline. I know it's been, just a few hours since this episode took place, but do you have any thoughts on what happened last night and this morning?
Well, first of all, thanks, Gareth, for including me in this very timely discussion, which indeed is changing by the moment. Now, it's interesting that on a number of occasions, the government has said it's going to threaten Khan over the last few months, and yet it has not followed up. And so again, over the last 24 hours, the government said that he was going to be arrested. And this time it looked like the government meant business, because he had a large contingent of police arrived, heavily armed. And of course, they fought back against Khan supporters who were standing out and in some cases were throwing rocks at the police. The police tear gassed Khan supporters, and they made it look like they really meant business. And yet they backed away again. Which I think is very striking for a number of reasons. You know, why would they keep backing away? Are they scared of Khan? Are they just trying to play games with Khan? Are they trying to gauge the reaction of Khan supporters to see, you know, how much they come out, to see just how robust their presence is? But, you know, as was just noted by Supriya, it was a pretty large crowd of his supporters that were out there. So my own view, bottom line view here, is that the army, which continues to exert significant levels of political power and influence in Pakistan, the upper echelon, the army leadership in Pakistan, really is done with Khan, and they would much rather not see him return to power in the next election in Pakistan, whenever that happens. And I think in that regard, there would be a strong desire to see Khan arrested at some point. The charges, we could discuss these. The charges, I would argue, are quite politically driven. But I think that those at the top army leadership, they really have no interest in seeing him return to power. So that means that we could see continued efforts by the state to try to sideline Khan in a way that it would make it difficult for him to be in a position to contest the elections whenever they take place.
Thank you, Michael. And just following on from that, I mean, in the past, we've seen the army exert, you know, influence, and ISI and the security apparatus exert influence in elections. I mean, as recently as the election in which, you know, Khan actually won. Why isn't this enough? Why do they need to oust Khan? Is it just a case of it's easier if he's out of the way? Or, you know, is this a special case? Why can't they just, you know, let it run and go ahead and influence the elections when they come about?
Well, I mean, the army is not used to civilian leaders pushing back in a really big way. And when they do, there's a tendency to take actions to remove them from power. And Khan is a bit different. You know, he's a populist who's very charismatic and has been able to command significant levels of public support. And he has capitalized on the grievances of many within Pakistan who did not like the way in which he was ousted from power. And Khan very openly and explicitly blamed the previous army chief, General Bajwa, for being behind the effort to have him removed in a you know, through the no confidence vote in Parliament. And Khan's rhetoric against the army was so vitriolic on levels that are very unusual. And, you know, typically when we see people in Pakistan express such strong, angry, explicit rhetoric against the army, you know, it doesn't work out well, quite frankly. And so for Khan to be doing this and for him to be referring to the army leadership as traitors and whatever the case may be, it's a pretty big deal. And I think also his positions, his policy views have on many levels been in alignment with the army, particularly when Khan was prime minister. But certainly during the last few months of Khan's time in office, he was taking on an increasingly anti-US tone, anti-West tone, that I think really worried and even scared the army, because despite a long period of a long history of tensions and volatility in relations between the U.S. and Pakistan, and Pakistan and the West more broadly, you know, obviously the army recognizes that the U.S. and many of the EU countries are key trade partners for Pakistan. And at a moment when Pakistan is experiencing significant levels of economic stress, crisis level economic stress, the army does not want people like Khan to be provoking and angering the United States. And obviously his allegation that the Biden administration was behind his ouster is also something that did not play well for the army, so to speak. So I think that, you know, these sort of are unforgivable actions, so to speak, irreconcilable positions, so to speak, or actions that have gotten to the point where the army simply does not want to see him return to power. And again, this is a pattern that's played out many times in Pakistan's history, where you'll have a civilian leader who cultivates great relations with the army that helps bring them to power, and then there's a falling out, and then things go in a whole other direction. So this is not, you know, we're seeing history repeat itself to a significant degree here as well.
And Michael, of course, you mentioned there the economic situation, and this is maybe where the current situation differs slightly. At Supriya, the Asia Pacific desk, and in particular, you know, the South Asia desk at Sibylline, has written extensively on this crisis as it's been unfolding. Can you just put us in the picture, Supriya, as it stands? Michael, you know, cited it, there's crisis levels. How severe is the economic crisis? And going on from that, something that we mentioned in one of the most recent podcasts, the IMF funding, is Pakistan likely to succeed in securing that IMF funding? Where are we with that?
The short answer to the question is the crisis is very severe. The last time I checked, I believe the consumer price inflation index showed 31.5% in June, which is the highest since 1974. But it's been a slightly better in terms of foreign reserves. I think with the onset of aid from China, foreign reserves are now at 4 weeks worth of imports. So that's a slight positive trend. But the situation still is very dire. And I think it's also because there's still fundamentally a difference of opinion between the IMF and Islamabad in terms of the negotiators. There are issues in terms of them, technical issues for them. For example, they both disagree on what is the amount of Pakistan's external debt. And Islamabad says it's 5 billion. The IMF believe it's 7 billion. And these are kind of technical aspects that need to be ironed out for the aid to come in. Also, I feel at some level, the IMF are a bit concerned about the political situation. I mean, they don't want to negotiate with a government that may not live to see the day. And I think Khan's growing popularity, and indeed, if he does go ahead and win the bipoles in Punjab, would only add to that anxiety and probably make the situation far worse. How close are they in securing the IMF funding? It's very difficult to say because the Pakistan government every week seems to come out and say it'll happen this week, it'll happen in the next couple of days, it'll happen the following week, and that doesn't seem to be the case. Interestingly, the IMF is not towing that line. They've been very clear about the fact that there is a set of terms that Pakistan needs to meet in order for them to give it aid. So there, again, it shows a bit of disparity between both negotiating parties. But they have until the end of the financial year, which is June, to secure the loan. And I think until then, it's really their bilateral partners like China and their partners in the Middle East, like the UAE, that will really be giving them sort of the lifeguard to like survive this crisis, which is going to be very difficult and obviously make the situation much worse for the current government in terms of their popularity, because the people are blaming the PDM for the cost of living crisis.
And just to briefly follow on, Michael, before we go on to international relations, sticking with domestic affairs, the IMF funding, Supriya in the past has written and spoken about strings attached, preconditions to the funding being released. What do you see as the most likely outcome, Michael, going forward in terms of securing the funding and possible domestic outcomes if that funding is secured?
Well, as Supriya said, it's very hard to predict what's going to happen. But it's clear that it's taking much longer than the government wants and perhaps thinks it to. And indeed, you're looking at a situation where you've got several weeks left of reserves covered, imports to be covered. So it certainly is a very tricky situation, to put it mildly. I imagine there's a good chance that a deal will come through eventually, though, of course, as you know, the way things work at the IMF, if there's an initial deal that comes through on staff levels, you still need to get executive level sign off to make it formal. And that process can take some time. So, Pakistan doesn't have time at this point. But I think there's a broader story here, you know, very briefly, and I think Supriya may have briefly referred to this, that the current agreement that the Pakistan has with the IMF, it ends in June. So that means that even if Pakistan were to get, this $1.1 billion in this latest tranche unfrozen, if there's an agreement on that, they're going to be back at square one, most likely in June, at a moment when I doubt the political uncertainty will have cleared up all that much. And I think that the IMF at that point will be very cautious, because the IMF would not want to be in a position where it's given, where it decides to give more funding to a recipient only to worry about a possible default happening after that. Because let's be very clear, even if Pakistan gets this $1.1 billion unfrozen now, that doesn't mean that there could be a default or a serious risk of one further down the road. And that risk, combined with the political uncertainty in Pakistan, which will likely play out in the coming months, may make the IMF a tough negotiator for sure. So this story doesn't end if Pakistan gets a deal in the next few days or next few weeks. It's all going to have to start again later this year.
Thank you, Michael. And Supriya, I mean, it's a very bleak domestic outlook, but I just want to pivot now onto international relations and firstly tackle, Michael, the relationship with the US. Where do Pakistan-US relations stand today? I mean, where do you think US officials want the relationship to go with Pakistan, and where is it today?
Right. Well, of course, relations were in a bad state during the last few weeks of the Khan era, and really the weeks after the Khan was removed in the no confidence vote, because of his blaming the Biden administration for his ouster, which obviously is an allegation with no evidence whatsoever. So I think that the government that took office in Pakistan nearly a year ago, in April of last year, sort of created new openings created a less toxic environment for the two sides to explore the possibilities for partnership. And, as you know, really ever since the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, the relationship had been adrift, because for so many years, Afghanistan had been the lens through which U.S. policymakers looked at the relationship with Pakistan. And with the U.S. out of Afghanistan, that meant that there was no longer a clear anchor for the relationship. So there was a lot of uncertainty even before Khan started making his allegations, and then things just got downright toxic. Things certainly have stabilized to an extent. I would argue, to be very candid, that in Washington, Pakistan and the relationship with it is not a a top tier priority. It's not a front burner priority. Things have improved in broader ways for a number of reasons. One is that after a period of several years, there's finally a new formal ambassador in Pakistan who arrived a few months ago. That certainly helped. And I think also last year was the 75th anniversary of U.S.-Pakistan relations. So that sort of gave an incentive for both sides to have a lot of high-level engagements, just to, you know, talk about, you know, to say a lot of nice things about each other and to celebrate those 75 years. But to be very honest, it's just not a priority right here in Washington right now. Geopolitics are very constraining in the sense that Pakistan's close alliance with China, I think, limits the scope for expanding partnership. We can get into that. And likewise, Washington's growing partnership, particularly on security levels with India, is a constraint for the relationship as well. So, you know, there will be areas of focus, and we have seen the establishment of several new bilateral dialogues put in place over the last few months, one on bilateral energy cooperation, one on health. Certainly the Biden administration wants climate change to be a part of its relationship with Pakistan. So there'll be some areas for engagement, but I think we're going to see somewhat of a more pared down relationship than we had during the years when the U.S. was in Afghanistan, and also a relationship that likely will focus more on non-security issues than security issues.
And Michael, you mentioned quite a lot of things I want to touch on there, particularly Washington's perception of Pakistan's relationship with China. But before we go into that, I'd just like to bring in Dr. Hugo Yu. For your perspective, Hugo, how strong is the Pakistan-China relationship? I mean, you know, CPEC has been there quite a while, that it's well known the relationship economically they have through One Belt, One Road. But, you know, since the US's pivot towards China, have we seen that relationship with Pakistan strengthen, again, maybe in the context of the US's withdrawal from Afghanistan as well? Hugo, just put us in the picture where that partnership lies.
Yeah, certainly. Happy to. I think it's fair to say the relationship is one of the strongest that China has with any foreign states. And that hasn't changed, you know, for the best part of the last, you know, decade or so. And the best to contextualize the Sino-Pakistani relation is to look at how Beijing's official designation of this relationship, which Beijing calls it as all-weather strategic cooperative partnership with Pakistan. And that's one of the highest level, I think it's the second highest level that Beijing designates to any other nation. So what that means, break down the term, rather mouthful term, all-weather means regardless of each other's domestic situation, like what we're seeing now, the political instability in Pakistan, regardless of the international environment of the day, that China sees Pakistan as very important strategic partner. Strategic obviously means very high level, multi-aspect with a lot of shared interests. And then cooperative is a level of relationship that indicates both will cooperate on international issues, whether, as you mentioned, about economic ties, trade, but also very importantly, geopolitics, political and military ties. And lastly, partnership. Again, that's the highest terms that Beijing would designate in terms of defining the nature of this relationship. For normal countries, a lot of other countries, they would just call it relationship. And to have a partnership, meaning a higher degree of shared mutual political interest and a higher degree of friendship there. So the relationship on a whole, it's in three levels, I would say, overall. Strategic and geopolitics, which Michael kind of already alluded to. If US sees Pakistan's relations, sees China being a very important factor, its relations with Pakistan, the reverse is true as well. Same principle applies when China sees Pakistan. So it's about counterweight to India, to India, a growing Western alliance with India. And there's also an element of opposition of the anti-US sentiment in there, anti-West sentiment. And on a separate level, Beijing also sees Pakistan being a very important conduit to its ties with the Muslim world. And that's quite important as well. And on economic and trade ties, you already mentioned about the China-Pakistan economic corridor being a vital link in Beijing's flagship investment and foreign policy initiative, the Belt and Road Initiative, and also attached to strategic importance of having access to Indian Ocean, you know, thinking about supply chain resilience, energy security. This is all it's very important for China to have access to the Indian Ocean, potentially could bypass having to go through some choke points that are controlled by the US and its allies in the Asia Pacific. And we see you know, similar examples with Bangladesh and Sri Lanka. And then lastly, you know, it is very important to use Pakistan as an important trade route through Central Asia and further to Middle East or to Europe. But its relationship on its whole is quite solid, but it's not saying it's not without any problems or issues. Recently, there's issues or debate about CPEC's funding, mismanagement of infrastructure projects, causing delays on some major construction projects. It couldn't bring yield benefit to the economic corridor. And there's also a wider issue, as we already mentioned, the debt level for the Pakistan's economy, of which I believe China accounts for 30% of Pakistan's total external debt. So it's a very important player in that sense. And lastly, and not the least, this probably costs the biggest headaches for the leadership in Beijing is the security and terrorism concerns. It is rising anti-China sentiment in parts of Pakistan, particularly in Balochistan, where you have separatist movement targeting Chinese interests, Chinese access. And some of these incidents, we've seen this trend of these type of incidents and hacks happening in major cities as well. And that could, and China has really urged Sanaba to really step up in protecting its own personnel and business located in the country. So security certainly is a concern for China, especially with their growing footprints, both economic and political footprint in Pakistan and in the region.
Thank you, Hugo. So comprehensive and so much there. I note the security aspect as well, and you know the rise of attacks on Chinese interests, which you know have resisted for many years now since the Balochistan separatist parties were seen to be attacking Chinese workers in Balochistan to what we have today, and we will address the security question actually. So I'm going to bring you back in there, but first of all, Michael. Hugo gives a really comprehensive rundown of how close the relationship is between Pakistan and China. Given, you know, the recent US pivot to China or away from China, however you want to phrase it, in Washington, what are their reservations? You know, what do they make of these close ties between Pakistan and China and the growing ties between Pakistan and China?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, it's interesting that in Pakistan, there tends to be two wrong and extreme perceptions about the U.S. and how it looks at Pakistan and China. And one of those is that this perception in Pakistan that Washington has essentially accepted the fact that Pakistan and China are close allies and that's it. And the U.S. is going to ignore Pakistan and try to contain it and so on and so forth. That's wrong. The second wrong perception is that the U.S. is essentially demanding that Pakistan choose between allying itself with China, putting itself in the Chinese camp, or putting itself in the U.S. camp. So both of those are wrong. And what really is the case, so far as I understand it, based on recent conversations with U.S. officials here in Washington, is that yes, there's a recognition of the fact that Pakistan and China have a very deep relationship, and that's going to limit the scope for U.S.-Pakistan partnership down the road. But what's interesting is that, you know, and this is all, you know, sort of a function of the U.S., of the very deep, bitter U.S.-China competition, the U.S. wants to ensure that it has enough of a relationship with Pakistan so that Pakistan is not 100% reliant or dependent on China. That's a very strong message that I get in my conversations with U.S. officials. You know, the question is, what could the U.S. actually do to reduce some of that dependence? And the interesting thing is, one thing the U.S. could do that could be very helpful in reducing Pakistan's dependence on China is if the U.S. were to open up more security cooperation, security assistance, and start sending, this very high quality, high-end military technology to Pakistan. That's something where the U.S. continues to have an edge over China on many levels, but that's not going to happen. Security aid, U.S. security aid has been frozen to Pakistan for several years, and that's not going to change. So I think that would be unrealistic to think that the U.S. would try to reduce Pakistan's reliance on China by ramping up security or military assistance to Pakistan. What I do think will happen, and again, this is a big part of the U.S.-China competition, it's a part of the U.S. Indo-Pacific policy, is that we're going to see U.S. officials try to look into the possibility of making, of pursuing infrastructure investments in Pakistan to try to push back against CPEC, which is indeed experiencing a loss of momentum in recent months. And the U.S. would hope to use tools such as the DFC, the International Development Finance Corporation, a relatively new U.S. government agency, affiliated with, which is a part of the Indo-Pacific policy, which sponsors infrastructure investments in Indo-Pacific countries. The U.S. does not consider Pakistan to be part of the Indo-Pacific, not part of the policy, but that doesn't mean the U.S. is not opposed to the idea of exploring the possibility of DFC investments in Pakistan, particularly in the area of clean energy infrastructure. And, final point on this, last summer, last July, a senior U.S. official, Dilawar Sayed, who is the State Department's Special Representative for Business and Commerce or Business and Investment, he made a trip to Pakistan for a week, which is a pretty long trip for someone that doesn't have Pakistan in their portfolio. During that week trip, he was talking about investment opportunities in Pakistan, and he had with him a senior official from DFC, which I think is quite telling.
Absolutely telling and very insightful there, Michael. A lot to take in, and we could probably make a whole podcast of Pakistan-China relations and the lens, the US lens. However, I do very briefly before we get onto the security environment. Want to bring India into this. And does the Chinese-Pakistan relationship, does that nexus pose a threat to India? Or indeed, is the perception within India that it does pose a threat? Michael, I'll just stick with you briefly, if that's okay, for that question.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the first point to make quite clear here is that India, and I know this is we're having a discussion on Pakistan, but this brief divergence is important. New Delhi views China, not Pakistan, as its biggest long-term threat, as its biggest long-term strategic challenge. Yes, it worries about Pakistan. It worries about the continued presence of terrorist networks and groups on Pakistani soil that threaten India and are sponsored in some cases by the Pakistani state. But it's really worried about China and the threat that it poses to India on its northern border, but also at sea with this significant levels of naval modernization in China, which has entailed a deeper Chinese naval presence in the Western Indian Ocean region. That is a big concern for China, for India. But given India's significant levels of concern with China, the idea of China-Pakistan partnership and China-Pakistan alliance, that's going to be worrying to India just because it involves China. And India knows that China has long seen Pakistan as a key ally, in great part because both China and Pakistan share that common rival, that common enemy in India. And certainly, as we've seen Chinese-Pakistan military cooperation ramp up, the prospect of China increasing military assistance to Pakistan, that's obviously something that's going to worry India as well. But the bottom line point here is that I think that India's major concern is China, not Pakistan. And so if we're talking about how we'll be concerned about this Chinese-Pakistani alliance, it's because of the fact that China is working closely with Pakistan. It's not because of Pakistan per se.
Absolutely, and I think that distinction is key to keep in mind. And I'm just now going to move to Supriya, and we've seen plenty of reporting, Supriya, from your desk about the various security incidents and You know, I think I'm right in saying that there's been a rise in terrorist attacks within the country with all the different various factions. This may or may not be linked to the situation in Afghanistan. Can you shed light on the rise in attacks? And is the, you know, the domestic security apparatus in a position to stymie this and mitigate this threat going forward?
Definitely, there has been an uptick in attacks. And I think for two main reasons. One, we've already touched upon briefly when we spoke about the withdrawal of US forces from Afghanistan, which gave a lot of leeway to groups operating there to then launch cross-border attacks. But then there was also the breakdown of a ceasefire agreement with the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, which allowed a lot of their fighters to then move into to Pakistan, and they've really been able to consolidate their efforts there. Regarding whether the state apparatus is strong enough, there have been certain successful CT operations, The most recent one was against Riaz Ullah, who was the TTP mastermind behind the attack on the police headquarters in Karachi just a few days ago. So there is some activity there. But by and large, I think it's going to be an uphill climb for the Pakistan army to tackle what is definitely a very worrying situation. The Global Terrorism Index actually just came out yesterday, and it said that 36% of Pakistan's attacks were actually responsible by the BLA, not even the TTP. And they are actually the fastest growing terrorist group in the world compared to, if you look at 2021, 2022 data. And this is a group that we don't really talk about as much because we're seeing the TTP simultaneously perform really high profile attacks in key cities. That's obviously spooking not just investors, but even people on the ground are protesting against the government for their inability to give them security. And it is definitely a very difficult situation. Something that I'm very closely monitoring myself is the spring offensive. Now that winters have come to pass, we usually see terrorist groups resume activity in the spring. The TTP is one of these groups because they model themselves on the Afghan Taliban, and they've always had a spring offensive traditionally. We've seen a bit of mixed signals from the TTP about this. We have the core TTP group commanders that have said that there won't be a spring offensive. But then we have factions within the TTP. I think one is the Hafiz Gul Bahadur faction that have said, no, we will go ahead and have an offensive. So there's a little bit of, I think what's happening is that the TTP is growing a lot faster than it can actually absorb, and factionalism within the TTP is growing. This could well be a good thing for the Pakistan army. But going forward, I think there will likely be a spring offensive, which means an uptick in terrorist activities. And potentially 2023 is going to be a difficult year for the Pakistan military because they also have to deal with the ongoing political situation. They're often called in. They have to be deployed when there's elections, and there's going to be a general election. I mean, we hope there's going to be a general election in October. They're definitely by polls. So they're definitely going to be stretched across a couple of different things in terms of domestic politics, in terms of the situation with extremist groups. So it's going to be a tough year ahead.
And Supriya, you know, many conspiracy theories exist about the, you know, the command and control of the Balochistan Liberation Army and the various Balochistan separatist factions, much of it in the realms of propaganda. What do you make of the spike in BLA attacks? Are they actually being assisted by the myriad of insurgent groups within the AFPAC region? Or is there another reason for it? Or do we simply not know?
It's a very good question. And I think the first thing to say is a lot of fighters have affiliations to different groups at the same time. And there is definitely a sense of resource sharing happening between them. And there's also a very clear supply chain that has been strengthened by the fact that Afghanistan is now run by the Afghan Taliban, which allows weapons to easily move across the border. So it's a bit of both, but I think that the conspiracy theories are not necessarily conspiracy theories. I definitely think the BLA that have managed to, I think 97% of their attacks last in 2022 was against Pakistani military forces. And that's a figure. And we do see that a lot in Northern Waziristan and KP. And we have statistics to prove that they are definitely growing in capabilities. And that's happening because of the things I mentioned before. So they're definitely a group to look out for.
And Hugo, you did mention Chinese fear over the security situation in Pakistan. I remember when I was based there myself, not infrequent attacks targeting Chinese workers, for example, that were involved in infrastructure projects in Balochistan. We had the incident in Karachi. You know, where does China see this going? What, apart from providing military assistance in terms of materiel or guidance even, what is the Chinese position on this? And what will the administration try to do to further suppress and mitigate the threats of Chinese nationals in Pakistan?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, from an outsider, it seems like the Chinese government mainly been sort of putting on extra political pressure through diplomatic channels, urging Pakistani authorities to step up in their intelligence gathering, monitoring, and their risk mitigation type of operations in preventing these type of attacks. And also make sure they look after the victims and the affected businesses when attacks occurs. So that itself doesn't come across enough if we continue to see a highly targeted attack against Chinese interests. I think it's China's kind of a military alliance or assistance to Pakistan, and in addition to sort of providing equipment, but also joint trainings. There were some activities on joint counterterrorism trainings, but that can only have limited impact if the information or intelligence Pakistani authorities do not have a very sort of a very accurate picture on these type of activities, or do not have the capacity to have robust monitoring programs, given what Supriya has alluded to, very stretched security services. So that could be a factor that why we see an uptake of attacks, but also could be a factor of continued increase of Chinese investment into Pakistan, and also the aforementioned issues that they encountered in some of them due to mismanagement and funding issues they encountered on along the CPAC route, and those infrastructure projects that has failed, at least according to the perception of the local population, and which kind of drive anti-China sentiment, that these projects has really failed reap benefit to the local communities and has not really brought a lot to the area, apart from serving Chinese interests. And certainly that's the narrative that the BLA seems to be propagating quite strongly in their strong opposition or their campaign against Chinese interests in that area.
Thank you, Hugo. And again, I mean, we have, anti-Chinese sentiment, we have the BLA, we have the terrorism piece, and there's so much more we could go into in terms of foreign policy and international affairs, let alone the economic situation. But we are coming up to time here. So I just want to level the final question at Michael, if I may, and put simply, what next to Pakistan in 2023, Michael?
Well, that's the question that we're all grappling with. For me, one of the things I'm going to be watching for is the electoral calendar. Yeah, I think that one reason why there's so much uncertainty and volatility in the political environment now, which clearly has a deleterious impact on the economy and negotiations with the IMF, is that we really don't know when the national election is going to occur. Constitutionally, per the electoral calendar, it needs to happen by the fall, by November, I believe. But the government in Islamabad has not been willing to commit to that. And there have been increasing reports that the government might use the pretext of economic stress and security threats as pretext for delay the elections. Given that Khan's main demand from day one since his ouster was for elections and early elections, but elections on the whole, if the government were actually to formally commit to the elections happening when they should, that could potentially be a de-escalator. Unfortunately, I don't think that's going to happen. But beyond that, in terms of where my eyes are looking, the IMF deal for sure. I mean, the economic crisis is just completely out of control right now. And I think that for the country to move forward, there needs to be at least some modicum of economic stabilization. And if the $1.1 billion comes in, yes, it's just that, it's short term. That, I think, would at least be a relief to investors. It would allow other funds to come in from other countries, as I think we discussed. And that would certainly bring some level of stability to what is obviously a very turbulent situation generated by this polycrisis of political, economic, and security challenges. So what I'm going to be watching is where things go with the IMF negotiations.
Thank you, Michael. And thank you, Supriya and Hugo, for your wonderful insight today. I'm sure our listeners have got an awful lot from it. And again, so many more questions to come from what has been a really insightful 45 minutes or so. But I think we are now against time, so we shall leave it there. Thank you to our listeners for joining us. Please do make sure you like and subscribe, however you're listening to this pod. If you'd like to talk about anything that we've discussed today, ask any questions, please do reach out to us. The email will be in the show notes. And if you would like to reach out or learn more about our guest, Michael Kugelman, acclaimed policy expert in all things South Asia, please do refer to our show notes, where I believe we will have his Twitter handle and bio page.